From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The two-party system in the U.S. today appears to be in serious crisis, with political polarization and seemingly insurmountable divides across the nation. But there is a precedent to this moment. Drawing from history, my next guest shows how the two-party system has faced an existential crisis before. Cedric De Leon is the director of the Labor Center and associate professor of sociology at University of Massachusetts Amherst. His earlier books include The Origins of the Right to Work and Party and Society. He's also the co-editor of Building Blocks, How Parties Organize Society. He now joins me to discuss his new book called simply Crisis, When Political Parties Lose the Consent to Rule. Welcome to the program, Cedric.
Thanks, Sonali.
So let's first talk about this part of your subtitle, Losing the Consent to Rule. What does that mean? And is that what the two major parties have lost today?
What it means is that they've lost the confidence of the wider electorate. So if you look at confidence in federal government, you'll find that actually only 19% of the American public say that they have some faith or a lot of faith that the federal government is going to do what's right for them. And that's the lowest percentage that we have seen since that question started getting asked by the Pew Research Center in 1958. I think that that's significant. And so when I speak about a crisis of public confidence, that's what I mean.
I want to pick up on a political moment that we all remember to draw parallels with one that most of us don't know about. And the newer political moment is, of course, Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016. And you discuss that at length in your book as a really important marker for us. When Clinton was the presumed nominee, and of course, even after she became the official nominee in 2016, her ascent to the presidency was essentially assumed, wasn't it? And that status as frontrunner, that confidence that she had, was actually quite tenuous in retrospect. Many of us, I think, are still shocked by what happened. But tell me about that moment.
Well, I think I discussed that moment in the book to show that Barack Obama's rise was very much unexpected, as was her concomitant defeat in 2008. And the reason why I speak about Hillary Clinton in this way is that it actually, that unexpected defeat, in my view, sets up the election of Donald Trump in 2016. In the immediate aftermath of the 2016 election, folks tried to explain Trump's victory by speaking about rising economic inequality, rising anti-immigrant sentiment, and so forth. But what I argue is that the election of Donald Trump has to do with the broken promises that emerge out of the 2008 election.
The 2008 election, you had an insurgent candidate for the nomination of the Democratic Party, and that was Barack Obama. Most people weren't in doubt that the Republicans would lose that race given the years before of George W. Bush. And here came Barack Obama and essentially blew Clinton out of the water in primary after primary. And you're saying that that was a foreshadowing of what happened in 2016. Why are we at this moment? What is your analysis for where we have come today? If not the economy, then what?
Well, I think it's an interaction between the economy and other social inequalities on the ground, and also the promises of the initial New Deal, which was, you know, Obama's progressive agenda in the 2008 campaign. My analysis of the situation is that essentially the New Deal was suppressed on the left and the right, that Clinton Democrats infiltrated the Obama administration during the transition and in the early years of his presidency, and essentially prevented him from realizing a progressive legislative agenda. And the result of that is that social inequalities that were there certainly during the recession were allowed to grow and fester. And the result of that was that insurgent movements on the left, Occupy Wall Street in 2010, the Black Lives Matter movement in 2011 with the assassination of Trayvon Martin, and then later the Bernie Sanders campaign emerged because they were dissatisfied with the Obama administration's progress on realizing their legislative promises. On the right, the situation was different because what Mr. Obama faced there was intransigence from Senate Republicans and their grassroots allies in the Tea Party. And what happened on the right was that essentially, you know, Senate Republicans thought that they could harness the grassroots energy of the Tea Party on the ground, but what they ended up doing was actually bringing in extremist elements into the GOP, which they were later unable to control. So you have on the left the situation in which inequalities are festering and the base is rising up in revolt. And you have on the right a Republican Party desperate to defeat Barack Obama and his New Deal, but in doing so, letting into the party extremist factions, which later destroy or fracture the party and result in the nomination of Donald Trump for the presidency.
There's a lot of evidence to suggest the Republican Party's internal destruction continues with the exodus of lawmakers, one after the other. House Republicans saying that they won't run for re-election, a few senators as well, whose positions are very tenuous. So let's talk about the historical precedent. Most Americans, I think I would safely say I'm among them, don't really know of the last time that the two major political parties in the U.S. were in such political crisis as today. Tell me about the parallel that you draw.
The parallel that I draw is with the onset of the U.S. Civil War. So you have in both instances, the contemporary instance and the historical instance, a moment in which the political establishment is being challenged from below and from factions on the left and the right. And in the historical instance, in the 1850s, what the Whig Party, which was the Democratic Party's main challenger at the time, did was they changed their legislative agenda to one anchored in anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic sentiment. And they thought that this would calm the American public, would suppress any debate about slavery in the unsettled Western territories, because people would become preoccupied with the menace, right, of the immigrant hordes coming across the Atlantic Ocean. But what ended up happening was that nativist move, that pivot, ended up backfiring on the Whig Party. And this is important because the Whig Party was the last institutional obstacle to secessionism in the South. And what the secessionists said about the Whig Party was that, you know, the only other people in the entire country who hate Catholics and immigrants are Yankee abolitionists in the North. And so the Whig Party must be allied with these crazy misfits calling for the end of slavery. And to prove that they were not abolitionists, the Whigs essentially abdicated their party. They said, oh, no, no, just in case you think that I'm actually an abolitionist, I'm going to join the secessionist cause. And so the result is this astonishing moment in which these folks who had stood against Southern rights all this time defect over to the Democratic Party so that there's only one party left in the South, and that is the party of secession. And I argue that that is essentially what leads us into the U.S. Civil War. And, you know, just in terms of the contemporary analogy, what I argue is that the political establishment's attempt to destroy the New Deal, both Clinton Democrats and the Republican Party, that attempt to destroy the New Deal ended up leading to their own demise.
It's troubling to hear that the last time we had this crisis, we had a civil war. Let's just hope that those aren't the kinds of things that come about today. Now, what about the way in which that same loss of the consent to rule that we talked about, you know, seeing today, how did that manifest itself? In the, 1840s, I guess. Was it 18?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the 1840s and 50s.
Yeah.
Yes, well, it manifested itself in two ways. One is that white voters on the ground who had longstanding allegiances to a particular party, whether that be the Democratic Party or the Whig Party, switched sides. Or did not, in some cases, turn out for either of the major parties. And the other way in which it manifested itself is through the polarization and fracture of the party system. So actually, you know, when we think about the contemporary situation, I'm not suggesting that, you know, somehow we have a civil war in the offing, but I am saying that we have a crisis of public confidence. Which suggests that lower percentages of the American public than usual do not have faith that the federal government will do right by them, and that we have levels of polarization that we have not seen since the middle of the 19th century. There's really actually only one time in American history in which the party system has been this fractured and polarized, and it was in the middle of the 19th century.
Is there a parallel to be drawn with the sort of nativist sentiment that we see today and the slide and even sort of fascist ideology and that historical era in terms of the talk of manifest destiny and what Americans, you know, felt that they deserved, if you will? And when I say Americans, I don't mean, of course, Indigenous Americans.
Right. No, I think you ask an important question, because the fact of the matter is the United States, like other countries in the world, is a settler colonial society. It was founded to benefit above all white male settlers, and many of them landless white people who had come to these shores in order to be. In order to become independent farmers. And, you know, the Civil War was fought in part over who would be able to move into Western lands, indigenous lands, and what was then still northern Mexico, and whether or not slaveholders would be permitted to migrate there, right? And what we see today in 2019 is a similar preoccupation with the privileges of white men, right? I mean, this is really one of the things that fueled Trump's ascendancy. This kind of disgruntled white working class voter in the upper Midwest, the so-called Rust Belt, who had believed Barack Obama and that, you know, that a new deal would bring in a new day and would bring them jobs in the middle of the Great Recession. But of course, you know, never received those jobs, never saw the promise of the Obama agenda realized. And, you know, and of course, those were the people, those were precisely the people who defected from the Obama coalition to the Trump coalition. Fully 12% of Obama voters from 2008 defected over to the Trump coalition in 2016. I think the link there is, you know, is this preoccupation with the privileges of less affluent white men.
What about those years that in the sort of 60 to 80 years after this political crisis in the U.S., we had, of course, the old New Deal, if you will, with FDR. And I'm wondering if that progression, that historical progression, is something that can happen here in the United States, today in the United States, but maybe at a faster pace.
Yes, I think it can happen here, but you know, one thing that that we often forget about the original New Deal was that it was created in order to mollify a very militant working class and also agricultural sector. Right. I mean, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which was meant to legalize collective bargaining for the first time in American history, and the AAA, which is the Agricultural Adjustment Act, meant to mollify, you know, mutinous farmers who were forced to sell their crops at below cost. These policies were given to the American people so that they would not stage an all-out socialist revolution. And I think that, you know, one way that regular people can set the public policy agenda for the next generation, as indeed that generation did, was to build a mass movement again, right, for social equality. I think that's, indeed, you know, every single major democratic transition and expansion in this country's history, and I dare say any other country's history, has happened because people have risen up and demanded their rights.
Cedric, you are a former labor organizer. You've written books about the labor movement. Can the current labor movement in the United States, the contemporary labor movement, which seems to be flexing its strength with a number of high-profile strikes just over the past couple of years, can today's labor movement find a path out of the crisis that we face today?
Yes, I think that the labor movement can really be, you know, a leader in a progressive path out of this crisis. You know, I think that the problem for the left at this moment, particularly during the Democratic Party presidential nomination contest, is that, you know, we perseverate about which one of these people is going to be able to set us free. It's like we're waiting for a politician to keep their promises, right, and deliver us from the, you know, widening inequalities of neoliberalism, and that's not going to happen. That's the people who we are waiting for is us, right? And I think that the labor movement has shown that it has the institutional resources and the political will to fight back against the economic and social inequalities that we face. Of course, the Red for Ed strike wave that has spread from West Virginia to Oklahoma to Kentucky and Los Angeles and Chicago has shown that, you know, a broad coalition of workers, not just white men, though white men are involved, but also women, immigrants, and people of color, can come together and force legislators of either political party to bend to their will. I think we saw this also in the Marriott strike wave. We saw it in other labor disputes as well out here in New England. The United Food and Commercial Workers staged a major victory and strike at the Stop and Shop chain in this part of the country. So as you say, labor is flexing its muscles. And I think, by the way, that the labor movement remains an institution that workers recognize as representing their interests. And so for that reason, and also for the fact that, as you say, they're very active in flexing their muscles at this point, I think that they can be a leader out of the present crisis.
What's at stake, Cedric? I mean, just looking at the historical parallels that you draw in your book, you know, we had a civil war. Eventually, there was and a very, very painful one. Eventually, we did, of course, slide back into some progressive eras for, you know, many, many Americans, never all Americans, of course. The moment that we're in today appears to be a make or break moment for the country. If we can't find a path out of this political morass that leads us to progress, I fear we have a slide into fascism. Do you?
I do. I do. I agree with you. And you know, what we are facing now is really two choices. One is to join the ethnic nationalist wave that has swept the globe in recent years. And it's not just here and in Western Europe, places like Hungary, for example. It's also the BJP and Hindu nationalism in India. It is also the AKP and political Islam in Turkey. This is a major worldwide movement, and we had better take it seriously. That's on one side. And I think that the only other possible alternative to that sort of divisiveness, right, anchored in ethno-religious hatred, is a vision and a program of solidarity, right? One that says that the struggle for economic justice is inseparable from the fight for gender and racial equity and for immigrant rights. That is really what is at stake at this point, right? It is the choice between ethnic nationalism and solidarity, and this is partly the reason why I think that the labor movement has some stature to bring in the fight that will bring our society out of the crisis towards a more progressive path.
Cedric, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with your book.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Cedric De Leon, Director of the Labor Center and Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's written a number of books, including The Origins of the Right to Work. We've been talking about his latest book, Crisis, When Political Parties Lose the Consent to Rule. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.